Hello, I'm Jack.
And I'm Martin.
And we are
The Washboard Resonators.
Welcome to our podcast, The Washboard Resonators present. Conversations from behind the red curtain on vintage music and stories from the entertainment industry. Hello and welcome to this week's Washboard Resonators present, where we are having the second half of our interview with legendary drummer Paul Smith. So if you missed the first half, go back and check that episode out. He goes into his details of his early life and how he became the drummer for Freddie Starr for over a decade. So amazing story. Go back and check that out. If you've already heard it, then stay right here and tune in for the second part. Here we go.
So I got this probation office in my mind because Mel Baker, one of the bass players I did some tellies with, went and did a mature student's course as a probation officer. I think that's probably where it came in the back of my mind.
Cool.
So I thought, well, I better get a degree, right? So I'll do an English degree.
Yeah.
Oh, I could. Cool. Now I'll do a music degree.
Yeah.
I don't have to do music, but I have to be a graduate. I'll do that. So I went to Huddersfield Music College. And I said, could I apply? I said, yeah, you'll need a reference. So I said, oh, so I rang Joe. I rang Joe Stones up at the Leeds College of Music. And I said, Joe, I said, will you do me a reference for the Huddersfield Music College? And he said, well, he said, why don't you come here? I said, well, I don't want to do it, play drums or anything. He said, don't do percussion and arranging. And I thought, all right. Well, I didn't get the interview at Huddersfield, so God knows what he put in the bloody reference. So I went to there. But Joe did say when I left, he said, that door is always open, Paul. That door never closes. And to his wonderful credit, he was a man of his word. I went there and I did the three-year course, and it transpired the midlife crisis. I was burnt out. I was done. I'd gone through a marriage. I'd done all that kind of thing. I'd built some properties and I'd done one or two things. I'd invested my money. I'd run a business, a shop. I'd all that sort of thing. So I'd worked myself to a frazzle. I took the 3 years out and I got rejuvenated back into music. And I discovered Mel Lewis and I discovered a lot of people. But it was great when I went to the college because I knew everybody. You know, and everybody thought, and they were very courteous. And Dale Gibson said to me, he said, if you're going to college, he says, I'm coming as well. So he came and we both did a mature students course. And then I did a 2-year postgrad course, PGCE, which I thought would be a load of rubbish, but it was a good development. I really enjoyed that. And then I realized that I wanted to get back into music because I'd had that break, that time to recharge.
So were you supporting yourself, the education, were you supporting that still by playing or were you getting that funded and you were living off of that? How was that working back then?
Well, I was paying my daughter's school fee. I was reasonably comfortable.
You had money and things to be able to afford.
I'm reasonably comfortable now. I'm not loaded, but I'm comfortable, you know, and all that sort of thing. And I'd sort of carefully, Robin Jack to pay, but gosh, how you've coped this last year, I've got nothing but admiration for you. But you've got to sneak things around. Oh, I'll pay that, I'll borrow that, put that, and I'll do this. And eventually you do it. And eventually you start levelling it up when the gigs come in and all that stuff.
Yeah, just surviving and making, I think, when you're a professional musician, I think, you know, this is a bit of a side thing, but you can, it's about when you do get money and you have leftover money, it's about what you do with it so that it's there when you need it. You know, just burn it. Because I think we all know people that just burn money.
My next door neighbour said to me, he said, well, I'm doing this. And he said, and then at the end of the month, I have some disposable income. I said, what's disposable income? Well, I never had disposable income. It's like when Linda and I first went on holiday. I said, Linda, I said, when do people go on holiday? She said, usually Saturdays. She said, when do you go on holiday? I said, when I'm not working. Mm. You don't go on holiday when you're gigging and all that kind of thing. You know, it's just it is a different way of life and all that sort of thing.
It is. But I mean, okay, it's just a question now. You've brought up the idea of musician in a different way of life. Is when you became a full-time musician, was it what you expected it to be, or was it kind of different from what you expected? And if so, what were the similarities that you expected and the differences? And did you have any ways of coping with them?
To be truthful, Martin, I don't know what I expected.
Right, so you were just going black, building into the dark then?
Yeah, I worked in my... I've had a proper job in my life for 9 months.
Right.
And that's it.
That was it.
And the rest is musician. So I didn't know anything else, kind of thing. And, and as a musician, I've earned a good living. I've never earned a fortune. I've always earned a good living. But I did the Northern Radio Orchestra, and Dave Hassell was on percussion, or I'd be on percussion, he'd be on kit.
Yeah,
and one day he says to me, he says, "I'm starting a day job tomorrow." I said, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm going to teach at the Royal Northern." So I said, "What, you're going to semi-pro?" Which he was going into teaching. But Dave is a very astute person. He's a wise boy. And a great musician, and he just saw that he needed to come back. He'd done what I'd been doing. He'd been with Tony Christie and he combined it with his teaching, and he got his teaching going. And I suppose that's where I got the teaching idea to come into place. I mean, once I got my, I got offered a job at Artform, full time teaching. And I was very flattered that I got the job, and I
was
took
this,
it.
Sorry, Paul, was this just after, so you finish your degree and you start working at art forms?
Yes, I got offered some work at the music college, but the money was like a shilling or something, an hour. You know, it was very poor, but the money at art form was very, very good. And I was... Ray Payne was my boss, who was a great percussionist.
Oh, I did a gig with Ray Payne. Yeah.
Oh, he's great.
West Yorkshire Police Band.
He's a super player. He's a super musician. I love him to bits. And he kindly invited me in. And I took the job, and I taught I was going to go full-time classroom in Tate High School, because Dave Robbins wanted me to do it. But all of a sudden, I'd kind of grown up, I thought, no, I don't want to do it. No, get real. So what I did, I went part-time, and I also had my private teaching, which has been phenomenal for me. It's been a great earner, and it was very busy, and I had my playing, so I had three jobs. So the argument was, I might lose two of them, but the chances of losing three jobs are slim. So I went into that. I formed a function band, which was called Checkers. At one stage in the band, there was Nicky Isles on keyboard, Mike Walker on guitar, Gary Culshaw on bass, Alison Parkin as vocalist. It was a great band, but I showed you how naive I can be. I didn't think it was commercial enough. So anyway, we got a more commercial band, and for 10 years, I ran with Alison, the top function band in the area. We did everything. We were doing all the Scarborough dances. We did all the strict tempo things, but it wasn't jazz. It was cheesy function things. And we were a quintet. The price was right, because it wasn't an expensive band, but they got a big sound, and we did all that. And then, like all these things, these bands implode. Everything goes great, or they come in focus, and the band imploded. But I think it was time for me to move on and do something else. So we finally split up, and then it enabled me to start concentrating on a lot more jazz gigs. And I also got in with the Moonlight Serenade Orchestra and the Andrews Sisters, and I thoroughly enjoyed playing that, because I hadn't done that
since you were about 12.
Well, yeah. So I wanted to be able to concentrate on it, and that was a great experience, and all that sort of thing. So it was constantly changing. But I've always been a devout student. I always want to learn as much as I can, and I also want to do shared learning. I love, you know, discovering things with students and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, I wanted to say that about when you said about teaching was, yeah, I feel like you just said you did teaching for the money, really. But I've having had lessons with you, and I feel like you enjoy teaching, and you like bouncing ideas off it. So I think, I'm not sure that, I don't think that was honestly said, it's just for the money. I feel like you're a very you know, honest teacher, really.
Oh, yeah, but the thing, yes, because, you know, I went over to New York. We used to go to New York once a year. And my wife says to me, what would you like for your birthday? Would you like a sovereign ring? Would you like a Rolex? Would you like
a Rolex?
Well, yeah, I've got to you know, colour it up a little bit.
I wasn't earning much as a musician.
what would you like? I said,
Rolls Royce.
I'd like a drum lesson off Ooh. Joe Morello.
Whoa.
And yeah, she said,
okay. So mm-hmm. she fixed it up. So I got...
What was that like?
It was...
When are we talking now, Paul? Are you?
We're talking about... it'd be about 2008, 2009, 2010.
Oh, wow. But Joe Morello is pretty old now.
It was pretty old then.
He's dead. Yeah, well, that's what I mean. I didn't think he lived long into the 2000s. But
I mean, yeah, well, I was probably one of his last students. I probably finished him off. He had periphery vision.
Yeah, yeah.
So you would sit at the side of him. And he had his kind of drum tech, who was a real sweet guy. And before my lesson, it brings me up, and he very cleverly said, hey, what do you think of this pad? And I didn't realise afterwards, and it was a weird pad, but he just wanted to see what my hands were like. So I just, oh, great, yeah. And then so he said, oh, his kid's all right. Wow. So I come in, and we sat at the side, and we sat and talked. And then one of the things that was fascinating was a triplet throw. And I said to Joe, where do I get this? Is page 13 of my book. Never forget those words. And it is there. John Riley, who I'd had a lesson with the year before, who was absolutely a genius, but he was heavily schooled by Joe Morello. And I wanted to take him at that level, even though I didn't feel I was that kind of level of player. It's wonderful to soak in their vibes and their energy and all that kind of thing. And a little bit of gossip and all that sort of thing. I had 2 hours with the great drummer, Billy Drummond, who was a great player. And at one point, we're in his studio. I think I mentioned this, Jack, you know, and he's got this 22K, and on the back of it, it says, from Tony Williams. You know, come on, you know, I've died and gone to heaven. And there's three of these. And the kit's there. The kit's tuned so high, I sound like a bloody beginner. I can't, it's like playing timbales. It was unbelievably high. And we go upstairs and there's a big row of 20s there. But he's in the lesson we taught. He says, well, what do you want me to play? I said, I want you to just play. And I want to sit here and soak it in. Because sometimes it's this Ringo Starr thing. It's this thing that isn't on the paper. It's not the technique. It's something. There's something there. And you've got to be in it. You know, you can hear a 12-string guitar strumming and it just has an energy. You can practice things, that rhythm that he's playing, but you've got to kind of understand how those people develop that lovely feel or where it comes from. So Billy Drummond was just lovely, and he had that ability of playing in 9 and 7 and make you feel as though he's still in, everything was one, but it was just absolutely beautiful treat.
I want to go back to Joe Morello because I really love Joe Morello's playing, and I'm sure hopefully a lot of listeners would as well. So what did you do? Did you have a few lessons with him or just the one?
I'd had two with him over the years, but the thing was, I studied with Jim Chapin, and Jim Chapin... Wow. Yeah, but I had a lot of time with Jim. I had a lot of time. So Jim came over and did two clinics for me, and he did all, and he stayed at my house, and we really hung out together. He was a sweet man. I mean, and you must know that story. I was in my studio and we were just talking, and I said, you know, when you were teaching Gene Krupa, he's taught Gene Krupa, for God's sake. I said, and you do this stick thing. And I played this stick thing. And he went, oh, hang on a minute, Paul. He said, I didn't realise you could play. I said, what do you mean you didn't realise I could play? He said, I've never seen you play. And I never played in front of him because it was his clinic and he doesn't want me prattling. Hey, folks, I've got a reasonable ability. And the thing that he said, which is a real compliment, he said, you'd be able to, with your technique, you'd be able to play when you're old. Well, I'm old now and I can still play reasonably well.
I think that's the exact reason why to practice and have good technique. You want to play as long as you can. I think
fluidity and all that thing. But I studied the molar technique with him, which was absolutely great and really mind-blowing, but it didn't tick all the boxes for me. I'm missing some. Went to see John Riley, still didn't quite get it. Then I went to with Joe, and Joe said, and he talked about George Laurie Stone. Then it all fell into place. My teacher, Jeff Myers, was a tremendously schooled player, but of course it was all secondhand. We talk about the great drummer Brian Bennett, and when we saw Brian play, he played like an American drummer. He had an American technique.
What do you mean by that? Can you summarize?
He played orthodox grip and he played real clever drum. Mitch Mitchell was the same. They didn't look like English drummers. They looked like American drummers. They had that lovely, he played like Jake Hanna or Elvin Jones. They had that ability. There is osmosis over there because you're mixing with it all the time. Here, you're working with fairly straightforward players, you know, more. They've not been influenced by these giant players as much. Now, of course, YouTube and everything, we have access to all that sort of thing. You know, I remember probably only 20, 30 years ago that I saw Shelly Mann on YouTube, and I didn't see him. You can hear him, but it is nice to watch him. You know, when I discovered the great drummer Mel Lewis, I think that's absolutely fabulous ability, but you've got to see him, you've got to watch him. One of the things I did when I was with Mel Lewis, it was, he said that Al Pacino was being interviewed, and Les Tompkins said to him, he says, who's your favorite drummer? He said, Mel Lewis. He says, but you're the lead trumpet player with the Buddy Rich Band. He says, oh, you mean the fastest or loudest drummer? And
Buddy wasn't in the room at that point then.
No, but the point was, he was saying that Mel Lewis made him sound good. Wow. Right? Now, the only way I can equate that is one of my favourite drummers is Dave Hassel. And I think I've told you this story. We were in the studio and we were doing some rudimental things, some rather clever rudimental things. And the producer came in and he said, wow, he says, I've got to take my hat off to you two. He says, you really play so tight together. I said, I'd love to take the compliment for that. I said, but it's him. He provides that lovely cushion with which to play on. And that's what is so important. You know, when you study with some of these other players, they're off on their own kind of approach, whereas Mel Lewis, and I'd kind of learn that with the Ronnie Tutt. You know, when you're driving a 35-piece orchestra, you're leathering it, you're playing a whacking backbeat. I don't think that Mel Lewis, if his life depended on it, could play a decent backbeat, and it's certainly not with calf heads and all that kind of thing. But it was nonetheless great being exposed to those kind of players and studying. And then when you talk to students who come along who probably learnt pop drums, and they say, I would like to become a jazz drummer. And they're always shocked when I say, right, we'll learn a tune. Well, they think, can't I learn some jazz from it? No, we'll learn a tune, just so they can start and feel where the middle eight comes and to play like a musician and all that kind of thing, which is so very, very important.
I'll just give you a little plug there. So you wrote a book about Mel Lewis, right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
When did you fit that in?
it's lovely. Andrew Bold wants to borrow it, but I said, I'm frightened to post it. I said, when I see you, I'll actually lend it. It was great. I did a vast amount of work, but I edited it down to 20,000 words. And it was because the reason I wrote it was because I couldn't understand this man. I couldn't understand his ability.
That's interesting.
And it was nice to try and get in. That doesn't mean to say I can play like that, but I can empathise now. I can begin to realise what he's implying. And he was so influential to all the top players and how it's used. And how when students come to you, you know, if they need a certain type of play, you can direct them to that kind of play and to know that kind of play as a teacher.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so where? So sorry, I made a side note when you went to New York and had these amazing lessons with. You could feel like you do a whole podcast on just the what you learned on some of those lessons for. I can't think of many people who've had lessons with that number of amazing, world-renowned teachers.
I was playing for Little and Large doing a seaside special.
Excellent.
Bob Armstrong was the drummer. It was one of the other drummers, and he was playing. And he'd just been to the States and had two lessons with Steve Gadd. And this was in the 80s, and he's telling me what he did. And of course, we didn't know YouTube, no clues, we didn't know. And he looked at his cymbals and he showed him these things. And suddenly you get exposed to this kind of wonderful thing. And when you're in Steve Gadd, I mean, I'd love to have had a couple of lessons with Steve Gadd. Not necessarily to have learnt anything, but just to soak his vibes. Yeah. I still got the presence of Billy Drummond. I think he was the most moving. Joe Morello is like Buddy Rich, he's, and Mozart, he's iconic. Mm. Billy Drummond had an energy and a warmth because he was sharing and he wanted to, wanted you to take something away with you. I had some lessons with Ignacio Baroa, which were very nice and very helpful. We did Dizzy Gillespie for a lot of time, Latin player and all that kind of thing, which is nice. I was going to do my master's at York, and I did the interview. I always remember it because the guy who was interviewing me was very esoteric and very well spoken. And I said, can I possibly do this kind of model? He said, well, it's not vacuum packed. He said, but he actually used hermetically sealed, and I wanted to say vacuum packed, but he'd like to use words that would impress me. And I was going to do all the Latin. So I did all the research for all the Latin things, which was great. It doesn't necessarily rock my boat because at the same time, I went to see, I didn't have a lesson with Elvin Jones in Bradford.
In Bradford? What was Elvin Jones doing in Bradford?
I know, you may well ask. I'm doing a concert there. And so I'd learnt this beautiful mambo with this tumbao and everything fell into place. And it's very quantized and it's very particular and you have to do it this special way. And then Elvin comes on and he breaks all the rules and goes, oh, wow. Now you can't do the pure Cuban things. Now Eto Moreira, who is a Brazilian percussionist, for the listeners, the basic difference is Cuban music is clave-based. Brazilian music is surdo-based. It's very similar, but they're very strict with the Cuban music. I much prefer Brazilian music because it's got the Portuguese language, which is soft-vowel, like Italian for opera, whereas Cuban music is Spanish, and it's very sharp music, and it's very, not my favourite kind of singing, but it's lovely to watch it perform. And it's also like listening to a timbale solo can be very beneficial for drummers because it just floats. It's not technique for technique's sake. It's creating a rhythmic illusion that's just an absolute delight.
Yeah. Okay, so what happened? So I wanted to go back. So you're after that, you're running this Checkers, the function band, and you're teaching. And then you're still... Are you playing for the band now?
Imploded. And sadly, it was a bit acrimonious. I look back now and I think, not sure why, but it was as these things happen. And I started getting some more jazz things. And then I joined the MSO and I started working with them.
What's the MSO? Sorry, Paul?
Music, Moonlight Serenade Orchestra.
Doing the Andrew Sisters stuff, you say.
Yeah. And I thoroughly enjoyed doing that, but it was an awful lot of travelling.
Did you buy a nice old drum kit for that?
I'd used my Ludwig Super Classic, 216s and 22, and array. I did my best Kenny Clare, and all that sort of style of playing. But when I got to the ripe old age of 70, my dear lady wife said, would I not do any more long haul? Would I stop doing long haul? And I said, yes. I then he rang up with about 20 gigs and I went, yes, I'll do them. And then I went, no, I won't. I said, I won't do it. It just took me some time to adjust.
Of course.
And now I just do lots of gigs, but local ones. I don't want to travel more than 2 hours away from home. Mm. How far's the farthest you two travel?
Where, anywhere. Yeah. When we do tours, they're quite well organised in that we don't generally do. Yeah, just the drive between gigs are manageable. Like, I don't know, but we did a terrible one from like Paignton back to Leeds before.
Oh, you know, like, we did the jazz gig at Paignton, didn't we? And what time did we set? We were playing in Paignton at like 2 on the dot, weren't we? We were playing, and for some reason we couldn't go down earlier. We couldn't find another gig. Did we set up at like 5 in the morning or something?
Yeah, thankfully, it doesn't happen very often. I quite pride myself.
6 hour drive, and, like, 6 hour drive. And then we drove back, didn't we?
Yeah, like that doesn't happen very often. Because same, like, yeah. Pride myself or ourselves in that. If we're organising gigs, like I do, if we get a gig that's far enough away and it's miles away, I'll just book a couple around it. Like, we've been around the country enough, got enough contacts. You're like, and normally you're going miles away, it's worth the money. So anything, it's just worth tagging a couple of them on. Doesn't really matter what you get paid alongside, like they're in.
One of the bands I worked with was Paul Baxter's Seven Pieces of Silver, which was fabulous, a tribute to Horace Silver. One of the hardest bands I've played with, and I absolutely loved it, brilliant. And sorry, it doesn't seem to come out very often, but we did a long tour around Britain. And then he said, oh, you got tomorrow off. Great, that's fantastic. But we're in Cornwall, and you'd be travelling home. Mm. So we're all in this bloody van for 9 hours.
Yeah.
And of course, YouTube, everybody's putting out pictures of us all kipping in this bloody van. And you're thinking, it's a rundo, this show business life, isn't it?
Well, me and Martin have to talk about that because we love that sort of thing. Sometimes you imagine, we're complaining now about being on that motorway for 9 hours from Cornwall. But can you imagine when you had the Larry Parnes tours and stuff and the pre-motorways, the Beatles or any Clem Cattini and other things driving through the night? It's nothing what we do compared to what they do.
We talked about that so much that like what it must have been like when you think that before the motorways, just to drive from say Leeds to Huddersfield, like where I'm from, it takes 35, 40 minutes. Where you drive through about 4 different towns, there's traffic lights all the time, there's other traffic. It'd probably take you an hour and a half to drive that same distance back in the day. And then you think about doing that as a musician, it must have been so much harder. And also, you know, like we can complain about sitting in vans and driving for hours, but we know what it feels like because of coronavirus to not work.
Mm.
And you've got to balance that a little bit. And
I miss it. Never thought.
Can I just share an entertaining moment? We used to work, I think, Great Yarmouth and Blackpool. So what he did, they flew us from Great Yarmouth to Blackpool, and then we went back in a coach. So we got flown up in a private plane. And on this particular private plane, I'm in the co-pilot seat, and we're there, and the band's with us, and Ted, the guitar player.
Is this Freddie Starr now? Sorry, Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was a bit of a daredevil, and he said, can I have a go? He said, because he had a very broad Yorkshire. Can I have a go? Will you give him a go? Well, he was an instructor as well. I said, yes. So I was in the pilot seat, without a word of a lie, 6,000 feet, and I took control, and I'm aiming at a cloud. I don't want to fly, but I did want to take the control. And I panned down to 4.5, and I turned right, and it was the most magical feeling. traveling in a bloody van, it was absolutely magical.
That's what I'm kind of, I think sometimes when you think about, say, being a musician, I think you've in many ways encapsulated it. There's this, sometimes this very hard side, but there are these like, diamonds in the rough where you have experiences that you would never have got close to without that way of life.
Yes. Have you been speaking to my wife? She says exactly the same thing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I haven't met your wife, but she sounds amazing if you talk about me. She sounds great.
So do you feel like you're in semi-retirement now, Paul, since you stopped doing far off gigs? Because you until coronavirus,
yeah,
I've always been known you you still do far off gigs.
I think I'm realigning.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm still learning, which is great. I mean, I'm doing a lot of trad things at the moment and thoroughly enjoying them to try and make them reasonably authentic, as authentic as they can be. But one of the things that I'm doing at the moment is I'm working with a great guitar player called Derek Harris, who's a fabulous musician, and it's a great privilege to work with somebody of his caliber. I've got a recording studio now here, and I'm set up with the Scarlett's an 18i20 interface, and I've got all the mics and everything, and it looks really very posh in here now. But I wouldn't have done that necessarily without Derek. We use Logic. He sends me over an arrangement he'll do, and then I can record it. So that's great development. So the word semi-retirement, as long as I'm learning and I'm developing, I feel there's a point to it. The thought of just going along and playing the same old, doesn't rock my boat anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody said, could you come and do a function gig? I'd go, no, but thank you very, very much for asking. I'm very flattered, but no, I don't do those anymore. But if somebody says, can you come and play this trad gig, or can you do that trad gig, or this big band thing that's around the corner, or this gig, I'll do that. Derek Harris has a lovely quartet, and we're doing some Bill Frisell things with pedal steel. And it's great to be in a musical environment. And in my way, contributing, hopefully, something that's musical and getting to meet musicians. I run the Head of Steam Jazz, and we're just opening the Downbeat Club at Glen Howe, and I run Kennedy. So I've got three residencies. I do every other Thursday or whatever at the Cross Keys during the day. Then there's another one. So, I mean, when we were out of lockdown, I'm usually about 5-6 gigs a week, and that's what I want to do. But none of those are epic travelers. They're all nice ones, and they're nice music to be involved with. You know, they're not, it's not something that it's a journeyman exercise. I'm really enjoying playing and all that sort of thing, and hopefully onward and upwards.
I think I feel like you've summed up what the impression I'm getting of you, really. It's just you're constantly wanting to learn and better yourself and just but have and enjoy playing music and things, really, I think.
Well, I must say, I do feel very privileged. A colleague once said to me, he said, what makes a professional musician? Oh, I said, that's simple. I said, somebody who can't do anything else. And it's whether it's through passion or ability. Well, mine's a bit of both. I've got a colleague, no names, no pack drills, who had 4 children, and I think as a musician was earning about 30,000 a year. Well, 4 children, 30,000 a year, not going to go brilliantly, but he also had a master's from Cambridge, and it was just when the computer thing was cutting in, and IBM said to him, and he wouldn't tell me how much he was earning, because he didn't want to offend me, but he gave me an equation, and my math is not to his level, but I think it was the equivalent of 58,000 a year and a Volvo supplied as his car. So which are you going to do if you've got 4 kids to feed and somebody offers you 58,000 a year and a Volvo? You're going to be awfully tempted, aren't you? I'd still be a drummer, but this particular.
But I also think you can kind of, I think maybe you did bridge that a bit, or something that I know, you know, I've always thought about it. A lot of people I know, pre-COVID that did shows, I think they often did that if they had a young family or something, because it was set in, or if you're London based, if you're West End or something, it was set in one place and you had a steady wage essentially. So maybe you sacrifice some of the musicality or the creativeness for a time being, as maybe I could argue, maybe you did with the Freddie Starr thing. I don't know, but you had a steady wage and you did it.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think we worked about 8 months of the year, and then I had a retainer for the rest of it. But the point was, I remember Ian Mann and I were once fitting a boiler together. We used to do things in those days. Well, you do, because if you're not working, you don't get a builder in, you get fitting a boiler together. And I'm halfway through it, and I got a phone call, and Ted said, can you get to Leeds and Bradford Airport? There's a plane waiting for you. Freddie wants you in the studio tonight at 10 o'clock.
Whoa.
Hey, but listen to this. This story gets worse. So I go, right, get home, change, goes in, loads the car, goes in the plane, gets down to London, gets ready to go in the studio. Where's my tom-toms? I hadn't packed my bloody tom-toms, and they were crucial that time because it was all...
Sorry, what, your drum kit was getting flown as well?
Oh yeah, everything was flown down. Bring your kit. No tom-tom. So I rang a friend of mine to bring two. I said, bring me anything. And he brought me two toms that night, got me out of it. But my wife drove down with four tom-toms, and I've been this posy bloody plane and dropped them off. And
that's a good wife there, isn't it? A good person, we shouldn't say.
Absolutely. Well, she realises the situation. But the trouble is, sometimes if you're caught on the... You know what it's like when somebody says, oh, can I pack your gear up for you? No, please
don't come anywhere near me. we've had that recently. When you're just getting back into gigging again, we've been doing gigging again, you drive to the gig frightened and you're going through your mind like where the stuff is, because in normal times, everything has a place. That even the audio you put into the car means that you don't forget anything and you are so organised. And when you're out of that sort of that continuity, it's quite scary. It sounds like you got you on that one. You just rushed out of the house.
You know, you have your regular work and you don't open that case.
To a fault, I need to change some batteries in my gear, but I just leave it and pack it away in the storage place. Yeah. I could actually do it going through it because it's just like you just don't even want to go there.
Absolutely.
And then like yourself, like, you know, you have a room full of the other stuff. So you can just use this for practicing, rehearsing, writing, and then you leave it set up and you go to the other.
Never the twain will meet. It's just
exactly
impossible. But actually, over the years, I think I've forgotten some tom-toms once, and I think I forgot some cymbals and a snare drum. So I did the three over 52, 54 years. So it's not a bad average.
That's good odds, is that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's reasonable odds and all that sort of thing.
Jack, you left your sticks at a festival once and we went to play a wedding up in Apple Tree, didn't you? Yeah, and that was scary.
Well, did I leave my sticks, Martin, or did you say you did an idiot check and the stick bag was left there? Who knows, you know?
Well, what about Ronnie Bottomley left a floor tom-tom on a wall, drove there and drove back the week later and it was still there in a case, obviously. Just sat there.
No, we've all done it. I left a Stompers bass drum. I think I left my washboard behind once, so I had to go back, and I realized I'd left the washboard and the bass drum, but I didn't pick up the bass drum even the second time. So I ended up clipping the toms onto the suitcase, and yeah, so that's probably my worst one. But yeah,
remember that there's another one which was just a weird one where we did a gig up at this bloody Rolls Royce Club up at Barn Aldswyck, and we did it with Lisa Stompers, and my bass amp, my double bass amp, was on the stage, and I put my key, jack driven in the van. I put my car keys on top of the bass amp and we played the gig. Dun, 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 dun. And what must have happened was the keys must have fallen off and then gone down like this. It was like a raised stage and down by the curtain. So we had no idea. So we got back to my, I think, house. I've been getting the house. And I'd stay on Jack's...
you stayed at mine. I'd
sleep roughly where your feet are now. And then poor Jack had sent me all the way back on his one Sunday off in about 3 months. He had to take me back to Barn Aldswyck to get the keys, and they were just under the stage. Mm. Oh, that is painful, isn't it?
The most, my parents left me with a lovely quote that said, don't lose your sense of humour. Mm. It's going to happen. You know, you do your absolute utmost, but it doesn't, you can't cover for every contingency and all that sort of thing.
I don't think you can be a professional musician without some sense of the absurd, a sense of humour, I guess a sense of not taking yourself too seriously, because otherwise I think you'd struggle and it would kind of crush you in many ways, because there's so many things out there that can go wrong or do go wrong, or situations in the back of vans for hours.
But also, how many times have you been driving back from Manchester and it's a detour?
A
straightforward 2-hour drive is 4 hours.
But it's I always think, whenever there's detours, I'd rather the detour than the 9-to-5 traffic every morning.
Would you really? Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Having some of the 9-to-5 driving now during COVID, yes, most definitely.
Oh, it's a good. I could never actually make the 9-to-5. I said 9 months was enough. I'd actually finished it at that point.
Yeah, let's hope I don't have much longer, but we'll see. Anyway, Paul, is there anything else you want to mention? Any other stories or any other things you want to bring up?
No, I think I've covered basically what I've planned here and all that sort of. There's a few things that I thought about, and I thought might be better kept quiet. And okay. Say there's one or two stories I haven't exposed. I'll save that for the news of the world.
Freddie Starr ate your hamster.
Absolutely. He rang me that morning, you know.
What, on the, after they ran the Freddie Starr ate my hamster story?
Ate my hamster. He said, do you realise? Pardon?
Was it the Sport or the Sun that ran that story?
Yeah, and he said, you know, next time, he said, I'm going to have to eat a giraffe, he said, in a sandwich. You know, the story, he did, to quote, this, you know, he just has to get, the stories have to get exponentially larger and larger in all that sort of thing. But there was...
Good job he started with a hamster then.
Do you remember a duo called Little and Large?
No, you mentioned them, but no.
I used to love, as a kid, Little and Large. I really did. And when you said that their drummer had a lesson from Steve Gadd, I find that hilarious.
I was playing for Little and Large.
There
was two drummers doing a live show. It was a seaside special, and they were recording. He was with Roy Castle.
Cool. Roy Castle from Home Firth. Well, funny if we're talking to this. My grandma, who's, bless her, 91, still alive. Where she lived, the Castle family lived, she went to school. She was in the same class as one of his sisters. They were the local hairdressers, the Castle family.
Were they really?
God. Yeah, in Scholes, I believe.
Scholes.
Yeah, I think they lived in Scholes, but she knew them quite well and used to go to the house to get a haircut by. I think it was Roy Castle's mum that was the hairdresser. Yeah.
But you know, you take Roy Castle, a sweet man. You take Des O'Connor, sweet man.
Well, you know, while we're on that subject, things, you work with these people, and obviously, you know, it's funny, Jack one day said, do you know about Roy Castle? I've just been watching him and he's doing some tap dancing and he's doing some drumming. I was like, oh, my grandma used to get a haircut by his mum. And it's, I've heard nothing but good about him. My grandma said he was quite a bit older at the time. She'd been about 7 or 8 and he was a bit older. But she said that the couple of times she had anything to do with him, she said he was lovely and charming and very nice. And, you know.
Well, he looked after the musicians and he paid them a good wage and he treated them with respect and all that kind of thing. But then again, he wasn't necessarily as iconic as Freddie, one of the sweetest men in the world, but Freddie was a kind of unique, strange one.
Yeah. Well, I think what Freddie managed to do, which is interesting, is you know, I think, you know, Freddie was somebody who somehow, I don't even know if Max Clifford is involved, but managed to become this tabloid figure constantly.
Max Clifford came to the gigs and everything.
Yeah.
Max Clifford. He was another strange character. Carry on.
It's a flying ball, but if you've ever seen the Louis Theroux thing about him, it's vile. But what you know, when I think, you know, it's funny now, like watching the Louis Theroux thing or what's happened with Max Clifford, when you look back, the Freddie Starr at my Amsterdam thing came to mind. It's like, oh, I bet that's a Max Clifford job. It's just the exact way Max Clifford, you know, there's sort of three ways.
Max Clifford was paid, he was his publicity man. He was create me publicity now.
Yeah.
And of course, it's surreal publicity. I mean, nobody could possibly believe it.
Bizarre tabloid tittle tattle or getting some guy to be photographed with some Page 3 girl or whatever it was. And ultimately, to sell tickets in Blackpool on the summer season, ultimately, that was the industry.
Yeah. Well, people want, the audience wanted to be shot, you know, and Freddie was the master of shocking people. But he had that ability to bring pathos into his humour very quickly.
I think what you see with a lot of those great comedians where that ramp up their kind of personality, this is why I think I mentioned about Freddie Starr, was he up or down in life? Because you see somebody whose act is that he's close to, you know, like almost like a breakdown and he's an extreme character, then there's the pathos. And you think, well, that's probably just him as a person.
I was working with Russ Abbott, and Russ Abbott comes. So Russ Abbott's the big star. And I'm sat on the drums. And Russ Abbott, and he comes right up to me. Paul, he says, when you see Freddie, he says, tell him he's a better comedian than me, but I'm a better drummer than he is. And I mean, great. And then Russ Abbott was a great drummer. Because I was on the gig and Russ said, hey, come and see me, Kit. He said, I've got Ludwig.
So we went,
and this is the big Russ Abbott, you know, and we just talked Ludwig. And he'd got an acrylic snare drum. Not a 400, but he wanted a Ludwig 400 and all that sort of thing.
Russ Abbott's, I mean, another somebody I grew up loving and stuff, he's great. You know, so you mentioned people like, Roy Castle, you mentioned people like that were nice people. You mentioned Des O'Connor. You must have had other people that were good. Like, I've heard good things about Bob Monkhouse. I've heard a couple
Bob
of people
Monkhouse
say he's the worst
for. An absolute genius. There was 10 of us in the band. And he came on stage and he got all our names. And he said, name, you know, very professional, bought us all a drink.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did a gag about everybody with the name and everything. 9 of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he came off. And he'd forgotten one. We said, he's bloody forgotten one. Yeah, clever bugger. So then he comes on, does his encore, bang, bang, big tag for the band, way.
Last joke. Yeah. I've got his autobiography behind me in the bookshelf. He's, I think, a genius and like much maligned as this like kind of smarmy, cheesy guy. But what I read in his book,
Photographic memory,
but what I read about in his book, and I think it probably is something which would relate to your drumming and the kind of people you worked with, that the impression I got from reading in his book is that nobody worked harder. Even from being a school kid, he was constantly writing jokes and constantly developing his act and doing everything he could do to sort of get the edge. You know, I think even when he was about 13 or 14, he gave Max Miller a joke. He waited for Max Miller and gave him a joke.
That's right. He said he was not a funny man.
No, he worked.
Dawson. Mm. I had a ball with Les Dawson.
Amazing. You worked with Les Dawson.
Oh, he was doing his act. And he had, what was the guy out of EastEnders that used to, with a barman, there was the two of them.
Mike Reed.
I did work with Mike Reed. He's another sweet guy, did loads of Mike Reed.
Yeah.
Yeah, but he was doing a double. And of course, I was falling about. I thought this Dawson was brilliant. And of course, they said, we must book him every week. And he was just a sweet guy, and a very, very, very funny man. But he looked funny. Bob Monkhouse does not, he looks like a solicitor.
Well, I think what one of the things that kind of came from that book and from what there's a nice little thing on YouTube, which is like something he did very close to dying. He did like a BBC special with young comedians in the audience. Somebody somewhere there mentions that it was very hard for him because he was actually a very handsome man. And often as a comedian, being handsome straight away is difficult to play low status, which is where a lot of comedy works, is the person falling down and breaking down. If you come on, you're sort of in shape and you're kind of good looking. So what he had to do was work really hard to have a massive range of gags for every situation and to have be able to turn the sixpence and remember them.
I did mention during the time working with Freddie, doing the Michael Parkinson show.
Tell us about Michael Parkinson.
He's a great man, a sweet, lovely, fabulous man. And we went round to Marion Montgomery's house. I never got to work with Marion, but I remember her showing me around her new kitchen. And Muhammad Ali was on. And I am not kidding you. Like I talk about Vera Lynn and I talk about the Land of Hope and Glory, and I'm talking about the mass hysteria that was created.
Iconic.
Almost Muhammad Ali walks on and you go, that star, mind-blowing.
The X Factor.
Oh, absolutely fantastic.
So out of all the people that you've worked with, and like you've seen Muhammad Ali walk on, or Vera Lynn, like who is the most sort of iconic or that has the most X Factor of all the people you've worked with?
Well, I've worked with the Woody Herman rhythm section.
Right.
When I was totally and utterly inept. And they came into the Ace in Wakefield. And they were playing at Wakefield Theatre Club, and they came in. And they said, can we have a knock? And we said, yeah. Oh, we haven't got our drummer. And I was only a kid. And he said, come on up. You'll have to come. I said, I'm not playing with these guys. And I mean, I couldn't hear what they were playing. But we went and they made me get up. And it was the most, I think that was the most fantastic to taste. The skill of, these are all Berkeley guys, and I haven't been exposed to that real heavy music thing, and it was lovely. It was lovely. The guys were beautiful. I probably irritated and thought he's a bit naff, but it was a great experience for me. So I think that was one of my most, you know, moving things. But I suppose Muhammad Ali, in terms of that star presence, I think you sense it the greatest there. That was a serious treat.
So, sorry, I might be missing something. No, here. Jack mentioned on the introduction something about Michael Parkinson. Here we are at the end of the thing. You brought up Parkinson. So what is the Michael Parkinson thing? Were you drummer on that show, or am I missing something?
I did the show with Freddie Starr. We had a 35-piece orchestra.
I see. So you Freddie brought his group in and did the show.
Yeah, we used it. Yeah. It was absolutely.
Is that on YouTube then? Can we see you on YouTube playing that?
You can, yes. You'll see me, you notice I have to take my hat off here. I'm follically challenged now. But then I used to have a big, big, massive afro.
You know, oh, really?
Big blonde afro.
That's what made you unrecognizable when I've done YouTubing. I was like, oh,
and a beard, and a big, and a big red, big, and a big red beard.
You've got like a big afro and a big red beard.
Yeah,
so you probably look a bit like Bob Ross or something then.
That's awesome. Yeah, well, it was kind of cool for the period and all that stuff.
Yeah, excellent. All right, I'm going to look forward to looking at that.
Interestingly enough, I did that show and I got one compliment from my teacher, Jeff Myers, who saw the show the day after. And he said to me, Paul, he said, I didn't think you could look after a big band like that. So I did get one compliment. But if I can tell you a funny story, there was a great drummer called Paul Brody who worked in the Radio Big Band. And I knew the percussionist, Paul Chambers, and we'd done lots of commercials together. And he saw the show. Well, Paul Brody, I loved his playing. And I would love to have been able to spend some time with him. So he says, who was the drummer with the Freddie Starr thing? And says Paul Smith. He said, I'd love to meet him. So I was so flattered. I actually went there and I watched Paul Brody play and he was out of this world. He was in class altogether. But it was really nice to meet him. And I think he liked my playing because I just had a different approach to him. But he was a consummate player. He was a skilled player. Just sat, everything was perfect and no mistakes. And just sat and played with the most obscure kid. And just a great man. He retired far too young from that band. Not an easy band, not an easy chair to keep up.
Yeah.
Radio Week. Yeah, serious playing.
So thanks, Paul. We're going to end now with we've got these four questions that we ask every guest who's coming on the podcast.
Oh, you said, yes, right.
They're just four little quick fire questions. Don't think too hard about them, but just give us your answers to them. So first of all, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your younger self?
Lower your expectations.
Oh, very philosophical.
it's a good one, that one, isn't it?
I feel like you, of a lot of the guests we listen to, you've actually had a very solid approach from a young age, actually. I think whether you knew what you were doing or not, but you had a methodical and had lessons and had these things and went through it. I think you followed.
I did have some very good guides on the way. Whether they felt sorry for me or whatever, I'm not sure, but I did have some good guides that pointed me in the right direction.
It sounds very organic, what I pick up from your entire story, is that it grew and was very, very organic. You know, it sounds nice.
Well, we sit in our house, and got a nice house, and I say to my wife, we're very fortunate. She said, well, we worked jolly hard. I said, lots of other people have worked jolly hard. But we still have had good fortune.
Yes.
And I've had good fortune to be a working, and I do emphasise that, a working musician all the way around. You know, I didn't become a superstar, I became a working musician. And yes, I am proud of it as I get a bit long in the tooth.
Yeah. Okay, brilliant. And next question, how are you explaining your job to a five-year-old?
How would I explain my job? I would say, I'm enjoying my job because it's great fun, and you should have a job that's equally fun, that is not a job, that is just doing something you enjoy doing.
Perfect. These are model answers, Paul.
Beautiful answers. I'm going to start crying soon.
Okay, let's see how vain you are now, then, Paul. So who would play you in a film of your life? Bob Ross, I think. We've already approached that.
Gosh, that's it. I'd like John Wayne to do it. I'd like that. You know, because
John Wayne?
Yes, it's got to be John Wayne.
I don't think I've seen you walk much. Is that why? Have you got a funny walk?
No, he's playing me. He's got to have his artistic inter. You know, when he's talking to Jesus and he goes, and Jesus is on the cross and he goes, truly he is the Son of God. You know, so I think if I spoke like that, I'd be really quite impressed.
It's the gravitas. That's what you're looking for.
Absolutely, yeah. I'd have to take the religious connotation away, but you know, the kind of coolness of it and all that.
Yeah,
the
cool
guy. It'd be fascinating.
You can leave the guns and all that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, and finally, how do you like your tea?
I like Builder tea. I don't have any sugar. I have white sugar, but I like to taste my tea. Not too strong, but like to taste my tea. In fact, my tea and coffee are very similar. And sometimes I really want a coffee, and sometimes I really enjoy a cup of tea.
Perfect. Hey, well, Paul, thank you so much for this opportunity. I think this is exactly what why we want to do these podcasts, really. Give people, as you said yourself, whether you know you're not famous per se, but being a working drummer, it's nice to me and mine love hearing about these stories of people who did it back in the, you know, well, we're talking 80s with you, really, aren't we? Well, we're not actually, we're talking way through. That's 60s, what's been amazing. 70s, 80s, yeah.
But the point is, if you remember when I came to see you at Seven Arts, and I've seen you many times, both of you epitomise professional working people. You see a lot of musicians that get a little bit full of their own importance, and we all can do that periodically, but focused business. But you are running a business, you are self-employed, you are having to make headway with that, and you have to connect with your people. And I think both of you, and that's meant genuinely, total respect to both of you for that, you know, 10 out of 10.
Oh, thank you. You
know, sound like Huey Green now. Met him in a lift.
Okay, well, that's a perfect spot to end there. We'll just leave it to the imagination of the listeners. All right. What happened in the lift. But so, Paul Smith, yeah, thank you very much. And I'll see you soon for another lesson.
Take care, my man. Lovely talking to you. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, cheers. Paul.
So there we go. That was the amazing Paul Smith. Any comments, Martin?
Well, that's so many. I mean, what I really dug about Paul there was he's like this bright shining light of loveliness, but there's another side to him, which is this: he's firm and he's sure and he's got his vision of what he wants to do, and it's clear that he has educated himself to a very high level, but he's also taken pride in working and doing a job, and perhaps sometimes some of those jobs are probably below his level, but rather than being a tiz about it, he's just being proud to support his family, to do his properties and to give himself that way of life. And I think it's come across so much there, and I feel like I've learned so much. I mean, you've known him for a long time and had lessons with him. What do you feel? Have you learned much there?
He's just filling a lot of gaps for me from, like, you know, you get talking about stuff, and I got a lot of respect for him anyway. And as I said in some of the earlier on, like when it is teaching philosophy, he's very much happy to learn from other people as well. Like, he actually changed in the position of his snare drum in the year meeting me, because he adopted to how I actually played it. Like, I don't really know, it's just how I did it, but he thought that made a bit more sense with a certain grip and the way he did it. So, like, you know, how often does that happen that you start having lessons with a drummer in his 70s who's worked with Joe Morello, and they take something from you, the student? Like, it's
I didn't know that. I mean, what that shows is that the guy is, and it came across in the podcast there, that he's still learning. And I just think, to me, you know, there's probably 10 things I could list that you could take away from that conversation that you can, as a person, learn from. And one obvious one is that the guy is still really super keen to be learning and to be developing new things. And I think anybody that can do that throughout their life is, you know, they're always going to feel like every day is going to feel like a new special day with new exciting things and a positive, the world will be a positive place to be in, to live in, if you're doing that. And I think that's excellent. you know.
He's exactly the kind of person where I wanted to put on, you know, why we started this podcast, really, because he won't really be known to most people listening to this podcast, but hopefully they've enjoyed it. And it's just a kind of a career of a working drummer who's worked at a very high level.
He's made a great living in a time when there was a music industry which was something which I think was, you could be anybody in any town in this country, you could get to a certain standard, and there was lots of work through agents that you could get to and then work up to you know, being the kind of band for these kind of touring artists, if you like, that came in and did a session, you know, whether it's these Bob Monkhouse comedians off the TV or whatever. And that world's kind of gone now to a degree. It's shrunk down massively, but there was a time when that was a thing. And I think he's given us a glimpse into that, and he's given us a glimpse into what it is mentally to kind of do this. And I don't know. I really enjoyed that. And I know you talk very highly about him, and that's the most time I've ever spent with him, you know, and it's nice to actually hear it all. I hope that what that does is for people now or future generations, that they hear that and, you know, that they can really get a feel of what it was like for these, you know, very important decades from the 60s, when, like, you know, pop and rock music kind of exploded, and what it was like for somebody that maybe wasn't on top of the pops, you know, or selling out millions of albums, but they were also working and supporting a family for decades.
Yeah, but I think, and but also all the Freddie Starr stuff, like he was filling arenas, you know, like,
I mean, what actually is there, I mean, really good point, is actually what that Freddie Starr thing is. I mean, one of the reasons I'm really obsessed with people like Freddie Starr is that they actually are part of a lineage which goes back to, I'd say, the Victorian times, if not before, which is, you know, whether it's a Max Miller kind of character, you know, from the 20s, 30s, 40s, Mary Lloyd's, Dan Leno's, people like that. There are these entertainers and performers whose name sold a lot of tickets all over the country during summer seasons, and the local band would come in and do it. And if you weren't good enough, you'd lose the gig and another guy would come and take your place. And, you know, they could work well. And when you think about it, you know, when you think about all those people that would work all year, probably in factory jobs, you know, working class people, all they had was that week or two in Blackpool, and maybe a week off at Christmas. And so, you know, the highlight of their year would have been to sort of go on the beach, and at nighttime they'd look and see what shows were on. You would go to that show on Tuesday, that show on a Thursday, we're going to see Freddie Starr on a Friday, you know. And that would have been, in many ways, probably the highlights of their year. And he was providing those evenings. And I think when you think about the amount of good he's done for people, actually, in their lives, it's beautiful, actually.
Well, and that's what we all strive to do, really, isn't it?
I think so. I think if you're going to be a musician, yeah, I think you've got to be of service. You've got to really be of service to people. You're there to, like, he's talking about entertaining, you know, whether it's the greatest serious musician and you find it entertaining, or whether it's by being a clown, whatever it is, and everything in between, wherever your level is.
Yeah.
I mean, this is now the longest outro ever, but I think we've covered a lot of stuff there, and it's interesting. Shall we say goodbye to the lovely listeners?
Yes, I think we'll say goodbye, and we'll be back again for next week's one.
Yeah, we'll look forward to sharing whoever we interview next week. We need to book it.
Yeah, see you then. Goodbye.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Washboard Resonators Present.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and leave a comment.
And to support our band, please sign up to the mailing list. You'll find the link in the show notes and on the website.